Welcome to Revere Asset Management's Your Money with Danny Stewart.
The market will always overshoot to the downside and to the upside.
And Don Vandenborg.
Because it's not how much you make in the markets, it's how much of that you can keep.
Great job last week, guys. Team Revere, thank you for letting me go on vacation, and you took good care of our customers, our listeners, and the general public while I was gone. It makes me feel great that the next generation of Revere clients in a decade or two are going to be in good hands. And Ted and Don are, Ted and Connor are doing a magnificent job, and they've got their own portfolios that are starting out, and they went over those last week. If you missed the show last week, you need to go watch it. It was one of our highest viewed shows, top five of all time, and people, the stock nerds, were really into it. And I think we're going to let them update their portfolios and give us an update of each one of their portfolios that they manage. And we're actually letting a few clients in those now, and we're going to give them an update each month, at least once a month. We may even increase that more if the demand's there, but we're going to let them update their own portfolios once a month and give them a little bit of a platform to tout what they're doing. And it is impressive. Now, as an advisor, I've got a question for the listener, because this is what's being put to us. As an advisor, should you give the advice that's in the best interest of the client always, or just when it's a long-term relationship? Said another way, is it okay to screw a client if you're just giving them one-off advice, if they're just coming to you for a one-time advice or just a short time period? Can you give them bad advice? Can you give them some product that's laden with surrender penalties, back-end penalties, the whole thing? Or should you always give them good advice? Well, that's what the new best interest rule is. And they're finally, I've been saying this for 20 years, that you should always give clients good, solid advice and put their interest first. I mean, when you go to a doctor, if it's just one time because you're seeing a specialist, should he give you bad advice if you're not his ongoing patient? What about a lawyer? If you're just going to the lawyer to get one thing done or get an opinion letter, should they give you bad advice? I don't think so. When you go to a store, if it's just your first time in the store and you're not a regular customer, shouldn't they treat you just as good as a regular customer? I'm just saying. In any event, the regulators, after 25 plus years, finally agree that yes, or they're beginning to agree, they still got to sign off and give the blessing on it. They're finally saying, yeah, you really should give clients good advice. Thank you for that clarification. However, there's still big annuities with huge commissions and surrender penalties and all that stuff. They haven't gotten rid of that. So folks, it all goes back to ethics, custody, and transparency. And that's why at Revere, that's what we do and why we're doing it in real time and why we put out all this content, because we show you everything we're doing, or almost everything we're doing, in real time. Don does a video every night about what we're doing. Now, speaking of transparency, have you heard of Integral Funds? Integral Funds, they're kind of a type of clothes. They're kind of a hybrid. They're
Interval.
Interval. That's what
interval.
I said. That's what I did say. Interval.
You said, you said integral.
Oh, okay. Interval. Well, I don't. They're both trash. You don't want either one of them. Interval or integral.
Right, but there's a dramatically different.
If you don't know what dramatically is, that's one of my sniglets I came up with a few weeks ago on the show, Don's inside joke. So in Interval Fund, thank you for that correction, Don, the facts and the risk, basically what they are is they're technically a closed-end fund, but the bottom line is they're a fund that can own a bunch of illiquid assets too. and they can do stuff. So they're kind of like the Hotel California. You can put your money in, but you can never leave, or you might not be able to leave because, see, the fund thinks it's their money, not your money. That's why we named this show Your Money, because it is your money. The investment banks, the insurance companies, and interval funds think it's their money. They need to be corrected. Anyway, so these interval funds, they can do all kinds of stuff, illiquid stuff. And so when you want to sell it, you have one day a quarter to put in your order. Say, hey, I want to sell all of it, or I want to sell 50% of it. You sell all of it, and they say, you know, we've had a bunch of redemptions this quarter. A lot of people asking for their money back. We can only liquidate 20% of the fund, and we've got a whole bunch of people wanting their money. So we'll give you 10% of your money back, not 100%. And then next quarter, on that exact date, if you miss it, you're screwed. You can do it again, and we'll see what we're going to give you, whether it's 30%, 40%, or maybe the whole thing. So you may get lucky and get all your money back. But most of these interval funds, actually, you get it back in pieces, 20, 25, 30%, 50%. It may take you 2 or 3 years to unwind the SOB. I don't want anything that's illiquid, especially in this market and at these valuations. I'm just saying. Now, one thing you may not have also known, and they've done studies on this, is they've got private REITs, kind of like these private REITs, where they're illiquid, they pay a commission, all that kind of stuff, right? And then you've got publicly traded REITs that are just traded very easily on the New York Stock Exchange. Actually, I think they're traded on the American Stock Exchange, but they're traded on the exchanges. Did you know when you look at the long-term history, if you buy and hold, I hate to say that, that the returns for the publicly traded REITs are about 30% higher. Why is that? Well, they did some studies and looked at it and said, wow, well, most of them have a 10 to 15% commission surrender penalty, but big commission they pay the guy. So if you take $100,000 and you stick it in there, they give him $12,000. They invest an 88 net for you. And then you got big surrender penalties. And guess what? That fund dramatically underperforms publicly traded funds with no commissions, and you can buy and sell immediately. It's not the Hotel California where you're stuck in there for a while. Why is that? Because the compounding and the commission itself, they start out in the hole, and then you lose the compounding on the commission as well. In any event, they don't perform as well. So why would you want something that's illiquid, has a big commission, and doesn't perform as well than something that's cheap, performs better, and is liquid, and it's not the Hotel California? You can take your money out anytime you want. Anyway, if your advisor proposes an interval fund for you, ask them how quickly you can get your money out. It also, the due diligence is tougher, because you really got to dive in deep and see what they own and stuff. And a lot of these illiquid assets, there's not a lot of so you really got to dive deep to do to find out. In any event, both of those things we're against. We don't like those things. We think you should own stuff. You should actively watch it, and you should pay attention, because again, it's your money, not their money. All right. Now, by the way, Biden is fighting against these big mega Roths, all four of them. Folks, there's a couple guys that got lucky, put some Facebook shares into a small Roth they had, and it mushroomed and became very, very big. And they want to do that. But wealthy people, billionaires, don't own Roths. You can't put enough money in Roths. There are limits. If you're over, I don't know, it's 80,000 or so, or I mean, I think it's 130, 140 as an individual. If you make that much a year, you're rich. You can't do a Roth. If you make 230 or 240 as a joint filing jointly, you can't do Roths. You're rich. Now, you can do a conversion and then do a Roth, but you pay the tax up front. Okay? If you really want to know how the rich get out of paying taxes, I'll tell you, they renounce their American citizenship, they get a European passport, they live in somewhere in Europe for 5 months a year, but then they actually domicile in Taiwan with Singapore with almost no income tax and 15% capital gains rate. That's how they do it, if you really want to know the truth. In any event, the rich, this class warfare's got to stop. There's not enough. You could tax the billionaires 100%, and it's not going to make a dent in the spending. The spending is the problem, not the wealthy. Now, what is the last thing? Oh, and there's also some Social Security things. I posted some of these articles so you can look in there. There's one on Social Security. There's a bunch of different ways you can file. I don't want to grind the show. Stop. But for clients, if you've got Social Security questions, you can call me. And we even have an outside consultant if it's a really deep dive. Because sometimes Social Security, if you've got spouses of different ages, sometimes it can get actually very confusing. So if you need any help on that, let me know. Now, I want to go, and lastly, Social Security estimates for 2025 jump 2.5%. Really? They jumped 2.5%? That's a huge jump. Inflation's about 3%, so you didn't really get a jump. Anyway, there's an article on that if you want to read. But I do want to go to the mailbag, and then we're going to the guys for the markets. This is on 313. This is BB. Hello, do you manage IRA accounts? If yes, how RMD required minimum distributions arranged? Thank you. We do manage IRAs, and they are our most common type of account we manage. We custody at Schwab for your own protection, as we do not custody assets. We are a fiduciary. Schwab calculates your RMD each year, and we help facilitate that. This is simply mechanical administrative duty, and you can do this yourself by calling Schwab, but normally we do this for the client anytime during the year they request, and we can set it up either monthly or annually at the end of the year, your distributions whenever you want. We are a full service advisor, and again, these are simply mechanical services. The main thing is, does our strategy make sense to you? And if you would like to have a phone discussion, we can talk and we can clear up any questions. That's one. This is another one. This is a client. Dan, got our taxes back and we got high taxes due to wash sales. Two concerns. Will losses not be allowed? The wash sales. Will the wash sales losses not be allowed and or made up in the future? And does this happen every year? Me. You never lose a wash sale when you sell that same security. They are netted together. Schwab actually adds the loss of the disallowed loss onto the buy when you buy that same security back within 31 days. And so that the cost basis of the next buy is higher so that it's automatically netted when you sell the next time. Okay, so I said Schwab actually adds a loss on any given wash sale to the basis of the next buy that created the wash sale. The problem is, and this is with all custodians, the problem is Schwab shows the total wash sales amount and it is not accurate because you used almost all of those up by the end of the year. There are only a few left, but that is not the impression given. So they total up all the wash sales during the year and they show you, you got $60,000 of wash sales. Well, you used up $58,500. You only got $1,500 left on one stock. They still show you the gross amount of that you had during the year, even though they're used up. That's one thing you have to understand. Okay. I said, I, like you, hate paying taxes. Here is the key, folks. This is the difference in strategy and what makes sense. You can either avoid taxes and have a random, meaning buy and hold, you can either avoid taxes and have a random outcome with large drawdowns, or you can control your destiny to a much greater degree with a smoother equity curve. Unfortunately, that comes with paying taxes sometimes in taxable accounts, not IRAs. Following a big bear market, I am grateful I avoided the large decline. Over time, you will pay much less taxes than you think, and the outcome could easily be higher than a buy and hold strategy, avoiding taxes, and is not random. In fact, most clients come to revere to avoid bear markets. These taxes do not happen every year. And if losses are collected in bad years, you will have loss carry forwards to offset the losses in future years during good markets. This is specifically to her. You came in after the 2022 bear market, or almost through it, so you didn't have any loss carry forwards due to her previous advisor buying and holding. In good markets, you will have taxes to pay, but you will have the money to cover those taxes. Please reach out if you have a better way. Here's what I'm saying, folks. In 2022, markets were down 20-25%. Ended up closing down 18.5% on the S&P, but at one point it was down 28%. But if you're down and you're a buy and hold or an asset allocator, there are funds or there are different stocks. You could sell Merck and buy Pfizer. They move in tandem for the most part. Or you could buy one S&P fund and get a large cap diversified fund that moves almost in tandem with the S&P. But you can book that loss and then buy similar things that move, that have high correlations. And when you get the recovery, you still get the same recovery in your account, but you have losses to offset any gains. Okay? If you don't do that, you simply write it down and write it back up. You don't create a tax alpha. They call that a tax alpha. Okay? It's very important. So I'll give you an example. This is years ago. This is back in 1999, the old firm I was working with. We made 42% for our client, did very well. The market was up 32%. It was a big year. I went through all the taxable accounts early December, late November, and I sold every material loss we had. So they only pay taxes on 6-8% of those gains, of that 42% gains in their portfolio. They paid less taxes than they thought. Now here at Revere, because we weren't nearly as active, I wasn't as active back then when I didn't know, I was early in my career. I didn't have all that technical discipline and sell rules to keep losses to single digits. We would end up writing things down 20-30%. Clients get freaked out, worried. When you keep losses small and you have active management, you do the loss harvesting on an ongoing basis. You don't have to do tax loss harvesting at the end of the year. In other words, it's already included in our process. Okay? So the gains, now in good years, yeah, you will have taxes to pay, but you'll have the tax. I'd rather have the money, the gains, and have some tax to pay than not have the gains and not have taxes to pay. But the main thing is you don't have a 25, 30, 35% drawdown in a month or two that scares you out of your strategy. That's number one. Number two is the studies called sequence of returns, which means that you've heard the story where you're 25 years old, you start saving $1,000 a month, you make your 8% annualized return, and when you're 65, you get the $1 million in pot of gold, the gold watch at the end of the day when you retire, right? You've heard that story. Here's what Wall Street doesn't tell you, and they know this, it's a big lie, is that the biggest determinant, the number one biggest variable on your quality retirement is the 3-4 years right in and at and right before retirement. Why is that? When you start out, if you make 8% on $10,000, that's $800, big deal. If you have $100,000 and you make 8%, that's $8,000. Not bad. If you've got $1 million, 8% is $80,000. So what I'm telling you is the last 4, 3, 4, 5 years is where 80% of all those compounded gains occur. So if you go into a bear market the year before you retire, your retirement nest egg literally can get cut in half. If you retired in 1990, now, their assumption being that you just liquidate and go to cash and buy an income stream, an annuity for life, which is another dumb, stupid thing, but I'm not going to go down a rabbit hole. But here's the bottom line. And if you retired in 1999, you had twice as much money than if you retired at the end of 2000 or 2021. If you retired in 2007, you had twice as much as if you retired in 2008 at the end or 2009. So timing is crucial. It's imperative unless you want to be random. Okay? And you've been told you can never time the market. The market always comes back. Yes, it does. And if you have the lifespan of an oak tree, you'll probably be just fine. But humans have about a 20%, 20, 30-year aggressive savings window. And then they've got about a 20, 30-year retirement window when they start drawing the money. So it's really important that you get your time horizon in sync with the market's time horizon, because the market does not care about you or your time horizon. The other thing you've been told is it's your risk tolerance. Guess what? It's not your risk tolerance. The market, the risk in the market, the sector, and the stock itself is way more important than your risk tolerance. So even if you tell me you're super aggressive, if that stock is crashing, I'm going to sell it because it shouldn't be held. Doesn't matter what your risk tolerance is. That stock is very dangerous. Leading stocks sell off 72% on average in the next bear market. Tesla was the leading stock in 2020 and 2021. I think Ted's going to talk about it later. In 2022, the leading stock in 2022, the S&P was down 18.5%. Tesla was down 69%. If you own Tesla, you lost 2/3 of your money. That's why it's important. So will that happen to NVIDIA? I don't know. It will happen at some point. I don't know when. NVIDIA may be a leader the next three cycles. So don't just assume a leading stock in the last cycle is going to be a leading stock in the next cycle. Guess what? We're in the next cycle. Tesla is the worst performing stock in the S&P 500. At least it's the worst performing large stock in the S&P 500, right? And 3 years ago, it was the stock to own. Now it's NVIDIA. So if you have an advisor that says, oh, this is a stock you can just put in your drawer and set it and forget it, or they want to sell you an interval fund or an annuity, you need to do some research on that. Make sure that's really what you want to do. At Revere, we feel that there's a better way. All right, I've set the table. Speaking of a better way, the markets were on a really gangbuster rally, and just recently they kind of got a little bit choppy and a little bit dicey, and we'll have to see. PPI came in hot yesterday, and it is kind of hinting towards stagflation. You remember that wonderful stagflation in the late 70s? So growth is kind of slowing, and inflation is starting to pick back up, maybe. I mean, PPI will be reflected in CPI next month. PPI means the producer's price index. It's coming down the pike. Anyway, PPI came in double expectations. I did put a nice article in there. You can read about it in the show notes. But again, it's not about the economy. It's about how the markets, or more importantly, the investors interpret the economy. And how are they voting with their dollars? Price is truth, and volume is very important. With that, let's go to Don and the team Revere. Connor is off this week. I'm covering for Connor because he covered for me last week. I appreciate that, Connor. But now we're going to go to Don and Ted. Don, take it.
Thanks, Dan. The first thing I want to show, let's go back to last night's video, Thursday night's video. In the subject line, I posed the question, is the market seeing a change in character? Because what we've been seeing over the last, little by little, things happen little by little, but then all at once in the market. I'm showing a chart of the S&P 500 right now, and it looks just absolutely fine, nothing to be concerned about. But there's a reason why we call our nightly videos Market Insight. We're not just quoting what's going on with the indexes. We're looking under the hood and looking at the individual sectors, individual leading stocks, and how are they doing. Are different sectors coming into leadership mode while others are exiting leadership mode? And that's really what about the last week has been about. We started showing really about a week and a half ago, some oils started showing up on our screens as starting to form some nice right sides of their bases. And then about 2 weeks ago, gold started acting well. Earlier this week, copper started acting well. And this coincided with a lack of further progress to the upside in several leading stocks, some of them breaking the 21-day moving average. But this isn't really showing up as damage on the S&P 500 because of the reason that we talk constantly about, and that is all sector rotation takes place within the S&P 500. It's why we use it as the ballast, the foundation in our accounts, using leveraged ETFs so that you can be 100% in the S&P 500 by being 50% in SSO. That other 50%, you can invest in T-bills, you can invest in other stocks, you can invest in commodities, you can invest in whatever is outperforming at the time. And that's kind of the way we run things. And what I'm showing is the S&P 500 here with this last inflection point. This was February 22nd after the big gap up on earnings by NVIDIA took the entire AI tech universe with it. And it trickled over to the indexes, and the S&P 500 had a big gap up. I'm going to go to a 30-minute chart here, and you can see where the big gap up was. And this was at this 50-40 level was where we opened. Since then, we've pulled back a couple of times, but really this 50-40 to 50-55 level has been a level of support, okay? And we're still above that. Nothing to be overly concerned about with the S&P 500. So then the question is, the S&P 500 is up. Okay, what's holding the S&P 500 up? Is it tech stocks? Now let's go to a 60-minute or to that same 30-minute chart of the NASDAQ 100. And you can see where all the way we gave up the entire gain in the NASDAQ 100. And we're actually below where we opened that day after a big stock like NVIDIA did its job by gapping up and taking the market with it. Okay, so then the next question is, well, what components is it of the NASDAQ 100 that's causing the lagging overall inside of it? So we'll bring up a chart of semiconductors. And you can see that semiconductors have given back quite a bit over the last week or so, but they're still above where they were with the NVIDIA gap up, mildly surprising you to think that we would have been higher. But this, as far as where is the money coming from that's keeping the S&P 500 up, you can confidently say that it's not the big stocks in the NASDAQ 100, or it's not all of them. So here's the semiconductor index where it's barely hanging on to the 21-day moving average right now. Back to a daily chart on the S&P 500, we already know we're well above the 21-day moving average. So look at the NASDAQ 100. We're breaking the 21-day moving average today. Okay, so everybody knows about the big seven. They make up a big percentage of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ 100. Let's go through these, and let's start with Apple. I mentioned this, I think, 2 weeks ago, that if Apple broke 180, that there's going to be problems with the market making continued further progress. You can see Apple has very clearly broken 180 and is struggling to hold on to 170. That's not a good look for the chart that is the second biggest weight in the indexes. On to some of the other ones. Amazon's holding up just fine for now. It's sitting on the 21-day moving average. Microsoft made a new high yesterday, pulling back today. This is typical. Something that's a leader poking its head above recent support and giving it back up the next day. This is the inability to make further progress to the upside of price, and we're seeing it in more and more growth names. Meta made a new high last week and now is pulling back, trying to hold on to the 21-day moving average. NVIDIA, very clearly the champ, but this looks like it could be an exhaustion candle with this big negative reversal. You can see we've been making lower highs over the last 4 days with NVIDIA. It's still the market champ until it's not. And for now, it's holding on to its 8-day exponential moving average. If it breaks that, the next level is going to be the 21 that we need to test. Google wedged up into the 50-day moving average and failed as of right now. Netflix. We have Netflix as the seventh in our Big Seven, and this is acting fine. But traditionally, the media's Big Seven has Tesla in there, and this is just acting like garbage, as Dan mentioned, and Ted's going to talk a little bit more about it, continuing to make lower lows while the market is near all-time highs. If you're still cheerleading this, you're totally ignoring price and you're letting your emotions get the best of you, no matter what Elon Musk has promised in the future. The market is deciding otherwise. And now from its high here back near 300, it's almost 50% off of the highs. And that's just from last July. Relative strength of a 9 means 91% of the other stocks in the market have outperformed Tesla over the past year. It's just pathetic. And then a couple of other stocks that are big, Broadcom, Snowflake, this was in the FANG Plus Index. It had a big gap down on earnings and has not stopped selling off by breaking the 200-day moving average. AMD is the 11th. That's trying to hold on the 21-day moving average after having a big reversal along with NVIDIA last Friday. So not the best of shape from those big 7, big 8, big 10, whatever you want to call them. Now let's go on to the RG8. This is the 8 growth ETF composite that we created in February of 2021 to serve as a better pulse on the overall growth environment. Now let's take a look at these. This is IWO, and you're going to see the relative strength line starting to lag on some of these over the past couple of weeks. And this also coincides with this gap up on Friday and reversal on two Fridays ago. So there's IWO, the first component. Second component, SLYG. Look at the relative strength there. Third component, MDYG. This is the one that is holding up the best. QQQJ, relative strength lagging. PDP, relative strength neutral. SPHB, this is high beta stocks, relative strength lagging. FFTY, look how choppy the relative strength line has been, and it didn't confirm these pokes into new highs that it attempted to do. ARKK, relative strength lagging. That's the RG8. So this is just more pieces to the puzzle that the overall market is telling us that things have not been as strong and are clearly weakening, especially on the mid cap and small cap growth names. Let's go to IWM. Broke below the 21-day moving average yesterday, tried to rally back above it and failed as of right now, although it is outperforming the big cap indexes on the day. But here's the NASDAQ 100, as we already showed, below the 21-day moving average. Hasn't been below the 21-day moving average since the day before that big NVIDIA gap up. And all of these, it's just kind of putting the pieces of a puzzle together. And when the weakest, when you're building a puzzle and it's all pieces of weakness that are being coming together, it's time to get more defensive. And we cut our exposure by half since the beginning of this week. In fact, since 2 days ago, we peaked at a 1.5 beta. As of right now, we're at 1.0 adjusted beta. So we've cut a third of our exposure over the last couple of days. And this is with a combination of offensive selling, defensive selling, and just frankly, our stops getting hit, taking us out of the market. We're not arguing with what's going on with the market. We're paying attention and we're acting accordingly.
And think about it, folks. If ingenuity and innovation, technology, that should be doing best and outperforming utilities and staples and more mundane names that have much lower growth rates. If those technology stocks and innovation stocks are struggling and they're not continuing to move higher, that's telling us the market is meeting headwinds and it's weakening in strength. Does that mean the rally's over, the primaries? No. It could be just a breather. It could be a moment of consolidation. That's why we're not jettisoning everything. You always want to do things in layers. You don't want to go all in or all out because the probability of whipsaw becomes much higher. As different levels and different, you know, Don talked about the 21 exponential moving average, and you got the 50-day, then you got the 200, and you've even got the 8 exponential, which is really short-term above the 21. All of those things are different layers, short-term, mid-term, you know, all the way to long term. He's making adjustments as he's getting signals from the market. The market is telling us what to do, not buy and hope. Okay, we're getting our signals from the market and making adjustments accordingly. We don't argue, and price and volume is truth. All right, Don, thank you. That was actually a very good synopsis. So quick question, just to kind of enlighten people. So right now, it's just a little bit of a pullback. You've lightened up a little bit. What are the, well, I guess you could have three scenarios. You can move sideways for quite a bit, but essentially, you'll either kind of break down or resume the upward trend. What are the signals that you'll be looking for either one to be able to do that, to know which one's the move?
Well, what are it's very common for leading stocks as they make moves higher to find support at the 50-day moving average. This normally corresponds with a pullback in the overall market, and that's what we're seeing right now, is a very mild pullback on the S&P 500, a little bit more severe on the NASDAQ 100 because it's very tech heavy. And the first to break was IWM and the growth components inside there. So we're keeping our eyes on what are the indexes doing. As always, we discuss them every night in the video, the major five. Their health goes into our overall asset exposure. And then what are leading stocks doing? If they come back, break the 21, find good, a low volume pullback and find support at the 50-day moving average and the market resumes its uptrend, that's a great buying opportunity for quality leading names. But what we've been doing is we've trimmed from 11 names down to 7 names and not a full position in any of them. We've got a quarter to a third or a half size in them, plus our plus some sectors. We've got Bitcoin, we've got an energy ETF, we've got gold stock ETF, and of course our S&P 500 foundation. And we take it day by day, like you said. No major overarching sell everything, the sky is falling. We just let the market tell us what to do. And right now it's been telling us to get a little bit more defensive, and that's what we've done. But it seems really that there was a change in character in the growth names over the past week. And,
oh, yes. No question.
That's very clearly.
Yeah. So, folks, he gave you a lot of – listening to Don is like drinking from a fire hose. Basically, what he's saying is if it continues to pull back, we'll lighten up a little bit more. And then the 50-day is key. If it breaks the 50-day, we continue to lighten. If it bounces and bounces off the 50-day, which happens that's fairly common, then we will immediately start adding onto the existing positions or new positions that have shown themselves because they've earned the right to make our watch list. So we don't have some idea of what stock is going to be the winner. We screen for stocks based on revenue growth, earnings, all kinds of stuff, and they make our screen. They're good enough. They've got good enough fundamentals to make our screen. And then Don goes through all those. And if you get too many stocks, you got to tighten your screen up. So he wants to get about 40 or 50 stocks in a good market. And then he goes through all those. Just because it's has good fundamentals doesn't mean it's timely. So when it's timely, so he'll go through all those and he'll pick the 4, 5, or 6 best technical setups that have a higher probability of moving higher in the short term. And that's how we screen. Once we start selling, we only sell on the technicals. So we're constantly dialing up and down the risk based on the market's risk, not your risk. Remember, the market doesn't care about you. And when the market starts to crash, they're just all lines on the chart. You need to be able to go flat and move quickly. You're not willing to do that. Here's the question I have. Don just showed you all the stuff that he's looking at and all the stuff he does on a daily basis, and he's doing this all the time with the team. Is your advisor? Does your advisor tell you these things? Does your advisor do a video every night for 15 or 20 minutes showing you what he did in the portfolio that day and then tomorrow what to look for? Methinks not, but I don't know. Maybe you do have an advisor like us. 98% of the people, I'm just throwing that number out of make that up. It's 95, 98. It's very, very high. Almost all advisors have a pie chart asset allocation. They put you in funds or a few stocks, set it and forget it, and then they go look for the next person, and they're not going to have a sell discipline. You should ask your advisor, what is your sell discipline and what would make you sell? All right, Don.
And also, a lot of people, you know, follow us for our technical approach to the market and portfolio management, but they trade their own accounts. I'm sure you've got relatives or friends and family that are with advisors that are just going to watch their money piddle away, all the gains that they've made over the last 4 months, because they have no sell discipline. So maybe you find our content useful, but we're never going to be your money manager, and that's fine. That's one of the reasons why we educate people the way we do. My father-in-law was with one of the big firms while he was dying of cancer, and they let his account drop 50% because they had no sell discipline. Don't let that happen to your friends and family. Have them at least have a conversation with us about what we are convinced is a better approach. And by the way, Dan and I have all of our money and all of our family's money in the exact portfolios that our clients do. So we put our money where our mouth is.
Yep. Absolutely.
Let's go on to Ted. You ready, Dan, for Ted?
Yeah, Teddy boy.
All right.
So continuing the theme, Dan was talking about how the markets don't care about your opinions. So I've talked about stage analysis probably 2 to 3 times, but I just can't stress enough how important this mental framework or this market cycle phenomenon is. And for me, I've studied the masters in many fields, and one similarity is simplicity. And that is kind of what I want to echo in my own process. I want to reduce as much noise as possible and reduce as much headache as possible. And so one simple mental razor I just have is long stocks in stage 2, short stocks in stage 4, in stage 1 and stage 3, don't touch it. And for the most part, that'll keep me out of any headaches. And that's what I think is really important, because if you lose your mind, you're pretty much doomed in the markets. Okay, so let's talk about stage analysis real quick. And then I wanted to talk about Tesla and compare it to those 2021 precedents, which I'm about to show you. This is the ARK chart. I always use this one. I think it's a textbook example of stage analysis. And as you can see, why I want to focus on stage 2 for longs and stage 2 for shorts, the boxes are by magnitude the highest, which means those are where the greatest magnitude moves happen. And also at the same time, they all also can be the shortest moves too. So you want to be in, you want to have good timing to be involved. And then stage 1 and stage 3, as you can see, it's a lot of volatility, a lot of back and forth mean reversion. And so you'll get chopped up financially and mentally too. This is RK. The premise is just focus on the 30, 40 week moving averages and their slopes. When price is above making higher highs and higher lows, that's when you want to be long. And you start seeing big reversals and choppy action and these moving averages to start to lose their momentum and flatten out, that's when you want to be careful. And then once price breaks down below a declining 30 and 40 week, that's where you want to completely be out of the clear or take some judicial shorts. So Don, can you pull up the next couple charts, Roku and Peloton?
Ted, I want to ask one quick question on that chart. Yeah. You don't have to bring back the chart, Don, but I just wanted to bring you back one thing on that chart. So when you said, you know, stage 1 and 3, it's just kind of choppy moving back, and you said you don't really want to do anything. Are you saying you want to sit on your hands and not sell anything, or are you saying you're trying to buy stocks just in stage 2? You really don't want to own those stocks if those stocks are in stage 1 and 3, and then you definitely want to be out of the way or shorting in stage 4. So if you're really you're not a long only portfolio guy, but if you're a long only portfolio guy, you really want to just focus on stage 2. I mean, you want to find stocks in stage 2 and be out of 1, 3, and 4. I just wanted to clarify that.
And we want to compound money, and time is part of compounding. We don't want to have money parked in stage 1 and stage 3 that just goes sideways and doesn't really give you any gains. And if you look at stage 2 and stage 4, that is really where the alpha and momentum come in on the upside and downside.
Good.
So I'll quickly
showcase. And you're
about to see
some stage four charts in the if you look at the individual names of the guy you're meeting with at the top of the
actually,
hour.
Actually, Don, before you go off RK, and I'll kind of talk about it for the other ones too. Dan cited that statistic, the average leader after a TOPS drops 72%. Well, I measured it here in that stage four, as you can see, if Don can point it out. I think that said 76%, right? It's a little blurry on my screen.
Yep, 76%.
So from stage four, from the entry of stage four, it's down 76%. Imagine if you bought near the top. I think this went 80, 90%. So that destroys a portfolio. That destroys a retirement account. And oftentimes, it never comes back. For example, the S&P and the NASDAQ are at all-time highs, and RK currently are sitting still 60, 70% from the all-time highs.
Yep.
And then if you can move
Kathy
on.
Kathy Wood actually owns the record, Morningstar said, for losing the most money of anybody that's invested in the fund because they all piled in up here, and then they got hit with this.
Wow.
Performance chasers.
And then the next two examples.
Yeah.
And then the next two examples, Peloton and Roku. I'm pretty sure Roku is one of RK's biggest holdings, so the chart almost looks identical. Peloton might have been actually as well. And as you can see from that stage four decline, once again, I think it's down 90% plus. Stage two is where the alpha move was of over 300% gains. And then that stage one to stage three area, you're just getting chopped up. You can't manage risk tightly. It's hard to find low risk entry points. And that's when you want to be out and focus on other opportunities.
But look at that. That was $173 a share down to four. That's why you can't buy and hold. And Peloton was a darling stock for a while, especially during COVID.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And same with Roku. You can see how choppy it was in stage one and stage three. That stage two area on the weekly almost looks vertical, just like Peloton, RK. And that's exactly where you want to be long. And then stage four, once again, very high alpha move on the short side. And this one, again, down 90% plus. If I can read that number correctly, Don, it's a little blurry for me.
Yeah, 91.99.
Over 90. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And now let's go to this cycle and talk about one of the previous leaders that is displaying extreme relative weakness. Tesla is also one of like the greatest stocks that made so many people money. And that gets really dangerous because imagine you caught that about 2,000% move on the upside. It really once you fall in love with the stock and you start staying loyal to it, your confirmation bias will be to look at every fundamental, macro, financial, business-related pieces of information that confirm your bullish thesis, even when the stock in the market is contrary to what you believe. And in the markets, if you don't align your opinion with the market opinion, you're eventually gonna lose a lot of money. Once again, look how choppy stage one was. It literally went nowhere. Stage two, the bulk of the move. Now the stage three pretty much went nowhere. Stage four, there's the stat again from Dan, down over 70% from the highs. Coming into this next uptrend, Tesla is showing some favorable characteristics, getting back above the 30 and 40 week moving averages and starting to form a stage one base. We got those 30, 40 week MAs to start sloping up and it started looking really good. It actually started breaking out of the downtrend line. It's not marked up here, but then we failed. And that's when we entered back into stage four. And this is where I want to point out, RK, Peloton, and Roku had almost perfect stage analyses, but Tesla is showing that we can go from stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, back into stage one. But then from that stage one, we can break back down to stage two. We don't have to, stage four downtrend. We don't have to go back into uptrend. Stocks aren't obligated to recover all of it.
And the point there, you know, the market went back into stage one and Tesla didn't, or back into
stage two. Yeah, the market did.
Yeah,
exactly.
Stage two and Tesla didn't.
And if I was running a long short portfolio, which we can't do with retirement accounts, like in my own portfolio, like I should be, like, it'd be very nice to have a little bit like into margin where you're long in stage two stocks and then short some of these stage four relative weakness stocks. And that can really smooth out your equity curve, but that's for another story. And then finally, how we saw Tesla kind of go back into stage one, looking like it's going to go into stage two and fail back into stage four. Now we have AMR that showed a stage one basing area, then almost a 2,000% move before consolidating in the stage three topping area, it almost seemed like. But instead of breaking down, well, it tried to break down and then it failed and went back into stage two. So I just wanted to show an example opposite of Tesla where we put in a stage three top and we're going back into stage two. And this is another variation of stage analysis, that these moves can last much longer than you think too. And it is important to get back into a stock once it is showing indications of heading back into this alpha phase of stage two.
Yeah, you know, Ted, you were talking about confirmation bias, meaning you actually see, like, you've got a hypothesis and you actually start to data mine and you pick facts that make sense to you that confirm, exactly. And you actually reject facts that don't. And that's a very good point.
Can I add something after you?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. So many of you probably know I was a bio major, so I spent a lot of time with the scientific method, and I think it really applies in the markets too. For example, you make an observation. So the scientific method kind of goes like this. You make an observation in the world, and then you create a hypothesis. You kind of translate that hypothesis into experiment. And in the case of the markets, that'd be taking a trade long or short. And then you get results. And the results are from the market, not some made up fantasy in your head about the fundamentals or macro that isn't what the market is giving you. And so once you get that feedback, then you can look at your results and make some conclusions and ask yourself, is it working or is it not? And if it's not working, that's an observation. So then you got to make another hypothesis. And then just in conclusion, so I just always want to align my opinion with the market's opinion. And I want to find, like, confirmation bias is good if you align it with the trend. And then once that trend breaks, you want to find a different type of confirmation bias that aligns with the trend as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And listen, so they've got a whole sector of finance called behavioral finance, which basically studies the thing, why do people act stupidly and emotionally given all the facts to the contrary? I mean, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but another thing. So Ted was talking about confirmation bias, but then at the very end, he said, just kind of very subtly, and when a stock sets up, you got to be willing to get back in a stock that sets up. One thing that people have a trouble with because of emotions, that's why you have to have rules, is if they buy a stock that's setting up and then it doesn't work out and they get stopped out and they lose a little bit, it's 4 or 5%, ooh. And so then they try it again and same thing happens. That stock sets up again and they go, you know what? I've never had any luck with that. I'm not going to do it. And then that stock sets up and then it really runs. That third time's a charm and it really runs. But you didn't do it because you have a bias, an emotional bias, because you hadn't been doing well. That's just the same thing as the Tesla groupies or the Apple. Remember all the Apple groupies that loved Apple when the iPhones came out? You get people that fall in love with the story, and then the story after a while starts to fade. The stock's been a real good winner and they stay around too long. That's what he's talking about with, and that's why we've got to take as much emotion out of it and try to be as scientific and mathematical and probabilistic as we can. That's also why it really helps us to have 4 or 5 guys all doing this together. We have a conference call every morning, an hour before the market opens. We have one right before midday and then heading into the close. So we're constantly, and if I think that Ted or Don thinks that Ted or Connor is getting a little confirmation bias or this or that, we point it out. In other words, it's like steel on steel. It actually sharpens it. When you're by yourself trading, those behavioral finance problems really rear their ugly head. You really got to be aware of them. And there's a whole bunch of different ones. There's a whole list. And you got to look at that list and you got to know what they are. And you got to double check yourself. With us, it's easier because there's, you know, Don's checking me, I'm checking him, Ted's, you know, so it makes it a lot easier. I just wanted to throw that out there. All right, so go ahead, Ted.
Can I share one last thing to end my segment?
Yes.
A quote about behavioral finance. Well, first, I'll recommend a book by Morgan Housel, Psychology of Money. Just a fantastic book on behavioral finance and investing. And then at the beginning of the book, just this one quote resonated with me a lot. And it goes, it's from Napoleon Bonaparte. He was one of like the greatest military strategists of all time. And he said, a genius is a man who can do the average when everyone else is losing their minds. And so for me, I just want to simplify my process as much as possible and keep my head when everyone else is losing their minds. And from that, you don't have to be so smart or anything. Just have to just do the average while everyone else is losing their mind. And in relatively, you're going to be doing a lot better than everyone else.
It's all about the relative strength. All right, Don.
Yep.
Great stuff, Ted. Great stuff. And you're right. You know, simple is better. And as long as you can keep your ego in your back pocket and admit when you're wrong and sell something, you'll never get into serious trouble with the market. Dan, that wraps it from our side today. I think you can take us home.
Thanks, Don. I like park it better. Anyway, folks, listen, if you like what you heard, please tell a friend, tell a neighbor. We try to be the most transparent fiduciary advisor out there. We show you what you're doing, what we're doing, why we're doing it on a daily basis. I'm not aware of any advisor that's doing that. If you've got any questions or comments, you can just go to revereasset.com. In the upper right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button, and we can get our daily market insight video Don does every night in this podcast delivered to your inbox. Next to it, there's a contact us button. It'll send me an email. You can ask about a stock, a complimentary portfolio view, or just a topic you want to discuss on air. And you can always email any of us at dan@revereasset.com. Don@revereasset.com or Connor or Ted@revereasset.com. Or you can always call us old school at 855-REAL-WEALTH. Folks, have a safe and happy weekend, and we will talk to you next week on your money, not their money, your money.
Because it's not about how much you make in the markets, it's how much of that you can keep.
Your Money Radio podcast covers general topics and investment ideas for research. It is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not meant to be investment advice. If you want or need investment advice, contact your own advisors or reach out to Revere Asset Management for individual investment advice. For more information, just go to revereasset.com.